From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. The GCHQ departmental historian Tony Comer came to Bletchley Park in November last year to talk about international cooperation in codebreaking, not least of which formed the foundations of the US-UK special relationship, which endures and remains vital to both nations to this day. In his talk, Tony examined some of the lesser-known collaborations.
It's not perhaps the best-known part of the Bletchley Park story, the web of relationships with other countries and other agencies. But I want to talk about that this afternoon and actually go back to an earlier period, to the period of the First World War, and the relationships that grew up then. Talk about what happened between the wars, talk about what happened during the Second World War, and then perhaps draw some conclusions about the necessity for signals intelligence organisations actually to work in partnership with colleagues and allies from other countries. SIGINT begins, as I think everybody knows, in August 1914. SIGINT, signals intelligence. It's not as simple as that. Nothing ever is quite as simple as that. There's a lot of evidence that people are beginning to research, finally, looking at what happened before the First World War and looking at the attempts made by a small number of people to develop cryptanalytic skills. These were tiny numbers of people in each of the War Office and the Admiralty. The Admiralty itself were prepared to allow a member of the Naval Intelligence Division, Fleet Paymaster Rotter, a very unfortunate surname. They were prepared to allow him between 1909 and 1913 to try to do things with intercepted German messages, but he never had any success cryptanalytically against them. And by the end of July 1914, when the Royal Navy was mobilised, no provision at all was made for signals intelligence by the Admiralty. This meant that on the 26th of August 1914, when the Russian Baltic Fleet captured two copies of the German Navy High Sea Fleet codebook, and they offered through the British naval attaché in St. Petersburg a copy of the codebook for the Admiralty wasn't particularly interested. The attempts that had been made by Rotter to do cryptanalysis against intercepted German signals had been completely unproductive. There was a general belief at high level, both from the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, and by the Admiralty Board, the Sea Lords, that encryption could never be broken. Encryption was the only secure way of doing anything. So even though the Russians were happy to say that they'd give a copy of the codebook to the Admiralty, if the Admiralty would simply send a ship for it, none was forthcoming. And it actually took 7 weeks until the Russians told the Admiralty that they'd managed to capture a copy of the German Maneuver Fleet Signalling Handbook, which basically had lots of pretty pictures of flags and showed the flags that German ships would fly during manoeuvres. That was the thing that impelled the Admiralty to send a ship. That was something they could cope with. The idea of hoisting flags and looking at flags through telescopes was something comprehensible. The Russians sent a copy of the High Sea Fleet codebook as well. It was the beginning of November by the time it had reached room 40 in the Admiralty, and it took 3 or 4 days to understand the way the Germans super encrypted the values coming out of the codebook, that they were able finally to start producing intelligence from the intercepted messages. It shows how important the contribution from the Russians had been. It's very unlikely that the people who'd been brought into Room 40 would have been able to make the progress that they had without the help of the Russians. As far as the army was concerned, its SIGINT organisation in the First World War, we know it as MI1B. MI1B was about its fourth or fifth title. There were a series of reorganisations in the War Office, but it's easiest just to call it MI1B. The army had had success against Boer traffic during the Boer War. In 1898, all of the cables going from South Africa to Europe had landfalls, and the army imposed censorship on cable traffic coming from South Africa to look out for evidence of the Boers actually trying to communicate. And in the censorship in Aden, they'd found encrypted messages from the Boer Republic during the time when President Kruger was in the Netherlands trying to drum up support for the Boers. Fairly simple encryption system that Major Church, in fact, Captain Church at the time of the Royal Engineers, who was in charge of the censorship effort, was able to break. This meant that the army at least had some idea that cryptanalysis could prove to be useful in war. The army set up a cryptanalytic bureau at Simla in India in 1906. It had some modest success against Russian, Afghan, Chinese, and Tibetan encryption systems. Even then, conceptually, they weren't producing strategic intelligence, and their thought in setting up the bureau in Simla wasn't really to set up something for intelligence. The aim was simply to understand how foreign countries encrypted the communications so that any documents that were captured during military activity could be broken out and read. The concept was that intercepted messages would only ever have tactical value and not strategic value. The origins of MI1B don't really, therefore, come from what went on in India, but rather the pre-war activity against a background of Anglo-French staff talks in 1912 in the margins of the International Wireless Conference led Colonel George McDonough, who was part of the Directorate of Military Operations and would become the first Director of Military Intelligence when intelligence was split from the Operations Directorate. He met Commandant François Cartier, who ran the French War Office's cryptanalytic bureau, and they agreed to continue their conversations. This meant that at the start of the First World War, the army actually had a plan to set up some sort of cryptanalytic bureau. As I say, it was eventually called MI1B. It began as a very, very small effort indeed. It involved the War Office librarian, who was responsible for censorship, and Brigadier Anderson, who led the incipient cryptanalytic bureau. He was in charge of it, but it was a half-time effort because he was also chairman of the Army Sanitary Committee. So any time spare from digging field latrines, he could devote to cryptanalysis. What happened in those first 2 or 3 weeks was that effectively the people who would become cryptanalysts actually learned how to do straightforward analysis. It was learning what the nature of the traffic that was being intercepted, primarily at that point by the Royal Navy's wireless telegraphy stations, actually meant. It meant looking at not the content of the messages, because they were encrypted, they couldn't understand them, but the externals of the traffic. What were the call signs? Which call signs were in contact with which other call signs? What time of day were these messages taking place? Were they regular daily calls, or did calls happen out of schedule? What frequencies were being used? Were the call signs particular to one entity, to one body, or were they multiple addresses? Learning how to analyse all of this material, learning how to sort it, learning how to classify it and file it were actually fundamental lessons that were learnt by the people who would become cryptanalysts. All of the work that today is called traffic analysis derives from these first 4 or 5 weeks of the First World War, where these techniques of deriving information from messages whose content can't be read were first developed. It also meant that when the French, who had broken into the German training ciphers before the First World War began, when the French broke into the mainstream German army encryption systems, they shared this with the British War Office immediately, and it meant that not only could they start breaking the new messages that were being intercepted, but they had already developed enough understanding of the way that the Germans communicated to be able to look at the backlog that had been created during the first 4 weeks of the war to work out which messages needed to be decrypted in which order. It led to a situation where the cryptanalysts from Room 40 were loaned to MI1B and worked together with them. What could have been, if it hadn't been for their withdrawal at the time that the Russian supplied German Navy codebook arrived, we could have actually had a unified signals intelligence organisation in the UK 5 years sooner than we actually did. The cooperation with the French was continuous throughout the First World War, though it worked in radically different ways between the Admiralty and the War Office. Because the War Office's concept of how to do signals intelligence was much more federated than the Navy's. The Navy believed in having a single centre at which all cryptanalytic and intelligence work should be done. The Army preferred a much more devolved scenario where intelligence was done separately on each of the fronts. So on the Western Front, on the Mesopotamian Front, on the Palestinian Front, on each of these fronts, there were separate organisations carrying out cryptanalytic duties. And it meant that MI1B had two separate roles, one as the sort of second line support, the area to which people would refer the most complex problems that couldn't be resolved by the front cryptanalytic organisations. And then also it took responsibility for the censorship, and eventually by the middle of 1915 started to work on diplomatic SIGINT as well as on military SIGINT. Because it was the War Office that started the work on diplomatic SIGINT, and because the War Office's relations with its foreign partners were handled at the front level by the soldiers in theatre rather than by the War Office in London, it meant that there was no sharing of information about diplomatic cryptanalysis. It wasn't an intentional thing that we will not talk to our foreign partners about the work we're doing on foreign diplomatic codes and ciphers. It was simply that there were no foreign partners for the War Office in London itself to share with. This actually ends up colouring a lot of the way that the partnerships work. Because they were focused solely on sharing information about military codes and ciphers, it meant that the relationships were very focused on tactical advantage and on direct support to the military rather than any grander political strategic information. There were no relationships in SIGINT with the Americans before they came into the war. There are a couple of very, very, very fragmentary pieces of evidence that attempts were made. In the US National Archives, there is a letter from the War Office, from an army officer to an American army officer who was a friend of his, saying that a particular German code couldn't be broken and could this American friend be of any sort of assistance. The American officer referred this letter through to the US War Office late in 1915 and was told he wasn't to enter into any correspondence about this subject with his British friend. And there is also evidence that the American cryptanalytic activity against Mexico early in 1917, that there was some thought from the American side of communicating to the British the fact that they were doing this to ask if the British were interested in sharing. But again, the decision was taken at the US War Office level that there wouldn't be any communication. Of course, America being neutral up to April 1917, it was actually the United States was a target of diplomatic SIGINT. One of the reasons of the delay between the sending of the Zimmermann telegram, when the German foreign minister offered the Mexicans an alliance with Germany, offered them Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona as war prizes if Mexico would join the war on the German side. One of the reasons for the delay in telling the Americans what the Germans were doing with the Mexicans was the fact that it was only known because it was on US diplomatic channels that the German encrypted messages were being sent. It was only when another copy of the message could be found that it became safe to talk to the Americans about what had been received. Because the British had cut the telegraphic cables that linked Germany to most of the rest of the world early in the morning of the 5th of August 1914, the Germans had had to evolve different ways of sending their messages. And their favoured way was to disguise them as diplomatic messages from other countries. So their usual method was to give them to the Swedish embassy in Berlin. The Germans would hand an encrypted message to the Swedish embassy in Berlin. The Swedes then would send it through to their own foreign office. It would go from the Swedish foreign office to the Swedish embassy, say in this case in Mexico City, and the Swedish cipher clerk would recognise it as a German message and pass it to the German embassy in that town. But the Germans also used American diplomatic channels for some of their messages. And it's probably the greatest single piece of cheek in the First World War that the offer they made to the Mexicans to join the war on their side against the Americans should have been sent through US channels. When the Americans came, there was an immediate recognition by them as the American forces reached Europe during 1917 that they would learn from the British and the French about cryptanalysis. Their preference was to learn from the French, from their own traditions, the idea that the US Expeditionary Force that came to Europe was there, as it were, to say thank you for the support that the French Republic had given through Lafayette during the American War of Independence. This was their return, as it were. But it became clear very quickly that they had so much more in common with the British that they began to send their cryptanalysts both to the Army Cryptanalytic Organisation on the front, but also to MI1B in the War Office. We know, for example, that William Friedman, who was probably certainly the most famous, probably the greatest American cryptanalyst of the 20th century, visited Cork Street, which is where MI1B was based, in January 1918, as did several other of the senior American cryptanalysts. The other relationship that there was during this period was with the Italians. Because of the threat from German and Austro-Hungarian naval vessels in the Mediterranean, it was fine that there were direction-finding sites in Gibraltar, in Malta, and in Alexandria. But in order to get a better cross-bearing, it was decided to cooperate with the Italian Navy in developing intercept sites in Italy to be able to better pinpoint the exact locations of enemy naval vessels. In the event, this was just worked on a very localised level. Nigel de Grey, who is actually the cryptanalyst involved in decoding the Zimmermann telegram, was sent out to Italy to establish a station. They eventually were two stations, but there's no real evidence that other than telling the Italians exactly what they were doing, that there was any cooperation. It's a very different world. It's hard to imagine nowadays that an intelligence organisation from a country could go to another country and say, can we build a listening station on your territory, please, for that country simply to say, yeah, do what you like, which is what happened. So though the sites were in Italy, there was no formal cooperation with the Italian authorities. So how did it all end? Well, there was still cooperation at the time of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. And of course, just across the corridor in Denniston's office in the display there, you'll see the pass that Denniston's wife had. She worked as part of the British cryptanalytic effort against the Germans at the Paris Peace Conference and her pass to get into the French War Office crypt organisation is there on display. It was a very close-knit relationship. But two things happened to bring an end to it. The first was that during the peace conference, the Germans found out that all of their diplomatic systems had been compromised during the war and, in fact, were being compromised during the peace conference. So they stopped using any of the encryption systems that were breakable at the time. Secondly, after the signing of the peace treaty, the American Senate wouldn't ratify it. The Americans went back to a very isolationist attitude and stopped cooperating. And Admiral Sinclair, who had his first period of responsibility as head of the Naval Intelligence Directorate, and of course when the Code and Cipher School was created out of the War Office and Admiralty SIGINT organisations in November 1919, it was initially under the aegis of the Admiralty. And he decided that basically we could do SIGINT by ourselves. We didn't actually need foreign partnerships. Again, in the sort of legend that grew up about the way that SIGINT had been organised, this became a much bigger deal than it probably was at the time. People talk about it still today often as though it was some form of formal doctrine. We don't need foreigners to do cryptanalysis. We can do it all by ourselves. I think it was a lot more pragmatic and a lot more transactional, and simply there was nothing that could be done that we weren't doing by ourselves. You have to bear in mind that during the 1920s, the Government Code and Cipher School was the most successful intelligence organisation there ever has been, and I would suggest ever will be. With the exception of two diplomatic encryption systems that were based on one-time pad, which, when used properly, is completely unbreakable, every single foreign diplomatic system that could be intercepted in the British Empire was broken by the Code and Cipher School. It's an incredible record. If I'm lecturing to an MI5 or an MI6 audience, I explain that this is because of the innate superiority of people who work in signals intelligence to any other form of intelligence officer. In fact, it's a reflection of how poor security was in the interwar period. People use code books and use code books badly. And the British use of encryption was just as bad as everybody else's. The proof, if you needed proof, however, of the fact that this was just a judgment and not sort of great doctrinal theory, comes from the fact that in 1931, Swanborough, that time Flight Lieutenant Swanborough, who was in charge of the Royal Air Force's SIGINT organisation, travelled to Estonia to talk to the Estonians about SIGINT cooperation. The main prospective target for the Royal Air Force's SIGINT operation was the Soviet Air Force. And unfortunately, from its station at RAF Waddington, it moved to Cheadle in 1937, at that time it was at Waddington, they couldn't actually hear any Soviet Air Force traffic. So Swanborough went to Estonia to persuade the Estonians that he would equip the Estonians with a SIGINT collection site. He would train Estonians in how to carry out SIGINT operations, and in return, they would send all of the interception that they carried out to him in the UK, so he would have traffic to analyse. And that carried on until October or November 1939. It's a demonstration of the fact that if there was the opportunity to get benefit from a foreign relationship, the organisations were perfectly happy to take that opportunity. It's a sadly untold part of our history, I'm afraid. So how did the wider contacts, start up again? As with so much of the period leading up to the Second World War, it's because of Enigma. We bought our first Enigma machine in 1926. It's intermittently on display here and at GCHQ, sort of year on, year off, where we display it. It's quite significant. It's not part of the story as it's often told, but our understanding of Enigma and how Enigma worked was pretty well complete by the end of 1927, even if there were no traffic encrypted on Enigma that could be intercepted in the UK. The commercial Enigma system was understood, but it was taken over in 1930 by the German military. And there were intermittent contacts by the French with the UK. In 1931, they sent over photographs of the military version of the Enigma machine, which was different to the commercial version in that it had the plug board on the front. And in 1933, Tiltman, who was head of the military section in the Code and Cipher School, went over to Paris to talk to the French. Nothing really came of this. The British cryptanalysts at the time were quite scornful of the French. They believed that the French didn't do real cryptanalysis. Instead, they just bribed foreigners to give them information. Of course, by the time they're about 12 months into being here at Bletchley Park, bribing foreigners or stealing information was dignified with the term pinches and had suddenly become a very good thing when it was necessary. In 1933, it was looked down on. That wasn't the way you did cryptanalysis. You failed successfully rather than resorted to these tactics. In 1936, during the Spanish Civil War, Hitler gave to General Franco 10 Enigma machines. And by April 1937, the traffic that was being encrypted on these machines was being broken. Again, it was a cul-de-sac. The machines that Hitler gave to Franco were examples of the commercial Enigma, not the much more complex, Steckered military Enigma that the German army would use itself. But this gave the UK information that it could share with the French about Enigma. The paper and pencil techniques that were developed against the commercial Enigma system wouldn't scale up. By late 1937, there was military traffic interceptable from the UK when the German army was on manoeuvres in eastern Germany, and the cryptanalysts who were working Enigma could make no headway against it whatsoever. This was the point at which negotiations with the French started again, and through the French, of course, with the Poles.
On Sunday, the 3rd of April, Bletchley Park presents Sir John Dermot Turing. Dermot will give a unique family perspective on his famous uncle, the codebreaker, mathematician and pioneering computer scientist Alan Turing. Tickets are on sale now in the Bletchley Park shop and on the website. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.